I'm Wendell.
And I'm Patrick.
And
this is
Yes
But Why
Podcast.
Until quite recently, basically everyone who was on TV or the radio had one kind of accent, which is called received pronunciation. And it's sort of, It's a half posh and half created accent that people have sort of made over the years to be the acceptable accent to have on TV. So I think there's a little bit less of other British people seeing that and thinking, oh, that's what we sound like, because they don't know anyone who sounds like that except on the TV. So they don't, you don't get the sort of the media dissemination of that.
Yeah. I feel like all newscasters have a kind of tone, though. Like, even from every place, they have a specific, like, and there's got to be, one of the interesting things about that is, like, there's got to be somebody who researched, like, the tone of voice and the way that, like, people receive information. Because, like for instance, on subways, the like warning voice is a man's voice and the instructor voice is a female voice, or at least in New York. And I heard somebody, and I didn't do any research on this, so I'm throwing fake information at you, but like, I had heard that that was because people responded to male and female voices differently. And I was like, how fascinating that someone would consider a certain tone for giving information or for instructing you or warning you. Like, I don't know. I just thought it was cool.
Yeah, no, I completely believe that. I think if we make it worse, like we like to do in improv, if you imagine you're on an airplane and the pilot's voice comes on, there are probably types of voices and ways of speaking that would make you more and or less confident about being on a plane that person was flying. I feel like vaguely in the back of my brain there's been a study about that, but I do not have the information to hand.
Oh yeah, no worries. One of my fun things about this podcast too, even when we're in person, is I won't let people Google things. I'm like, nah, just say it wrong. Who cares? Like, this is not a news website. This is not like an information-based podcast. This is an interview. We could talk for 45 minutes about how your favorite chocolate is whatever. Doesn't matter. It's about people, right? So Doesn't matter if we tell fake stories. I'm down with a possible a study on tone of voice. I mean, there has to be, right? There's whole journalism schools teaching people how to have a certain timbre of voice, both in the UK, I know definitely in the US. Like, super interesting, and interesting that there are, that it's sort of its own art. You know what I mean? Like it's a stiffer sort of art than say improv, but it definitely has its own beauty to it. Like the certain way that a person sits and speaks and shares this information with you in this sort of like emotionless way. Really interesting. Fascinating.
Yeah. I feel like politicians do very much the same thing. You can kind of, in terms of the way that they stand and the way that they speak, there's often a lot of similarity. And I'm sure somebody's just studied the most effective way to do that, and then they're all just copying it.
Oh, I hope so. If they're not, they're not working hard enough. Get in there, politicians, especially you new politicians, people who are joining. He's right. There's a way to do it. There's a tone of voice. There's a kind of thing. I mean, and you're right. Like, what a smart like example of it, pilots. Yeah, of course. That like slow, like even the pauses, the like long, like it's like he's so cool, he's just pausing everywhere. That's what like that means. That shows us it's like, hey man, relax, this guy is gonna take a 45 minute pause between words, we're fine. Like Oh, man. So you're from Canada. I know a small tiny bit about Canada. And one of the things that I know about Canada is that they have a lot of improv there, that there is not only like as an adult, but like as kids and stuff. Did you have improv in school?
I'm a little bit too old for that to have been a thing when I was in school, but really? Theater sports
are... So that's like a newer
are...
thing. Interesting.
It is, yeah. Well, I'm 34, so there's potentially a generation of people younger than me who did get that, which is really cool. Hmm. But I know theater sports are big across the city and there's like, or across the country, and from Vancouver, where I'm from, there's championships and teams all over the place. Yeah, and that's really cool.
Did you get started in improv in Vancouver?
I didn't. So I did my master's degree in Montreal, and I started doing improv there, actually, because my master's degree, my thesis was about how people learn to improvise music. I ended up reading a bunch about dance improv and theater improv, and that's what got me into it in the first place. So I read 10 improv books and then tried it, which was not the right way to do it, but it was fun anyway.
Oh my God. I can't even imagine. I have a hard time getting through improv books because for me, it's such a visceral experience versus something that I can, I don't know, write down, I guess. I mean, I teach it, so I guess, sorry, every student I've ever had, I swear I do think of it analytically, but... But, you know, it certainly feels more visceral. So you wrote your thesis on improvised music, and it was the research that got you into improv. So then did you do improv in Montreal? What happened next? How did you get involved in, or what were you doing in college that you wrote a thesis on improvised music? What was your degree in?
My degree was in solo contemporary bass clarinet performance.
Very specific.
I have never met anyone else who has that degree, so probably I'm the best ever.
Excellent.
Yeah. So because my thesis was about free improv, which is like a specific type of improvised music that doesn't have rules or chords or anything, there wasn't a lot of research about it, because if there are no rules, how specifically are people getting better at it? And what does it look like to be good at something with no rules? And how are people teaching it? So I had to look outside of the literature that was available. And I think the stuff that I found has informed my approach for teaching both music and theater right the way through, because it's true. Even in improvised theater or comedy, there are rules, but there are almost always times where you can break them, and it's absolutely the right decision.
Yeah, totally. So you started out in music, and it sounds like you've continued in music. What was your first job out of school? What did you do? Did you start teaching right away?
I did. Well, I've been teaching since high school, just private lessons, and so I conduct ensembles as well. And I used to freelance a lot just as a player. I've sort of, as I've got older, done less and less music and more improvised theater and comedy, just because I like it better at this point in my life. I find it more interesting and more challenging and more surprising. So that's most of my profession at this point.
Hmm. That's interesting. So tell me first, though, before we get into the theater, like what led you to teaching music? I mean, you're in teaching private lessons since you were in high school. You clearly have a sort of mentor nature. I mean, you know, people don't start teaching that early unless they're like, you know, meant to do it. So in that instance, how did you get started teaching people, even though you were quite young at the time?
I think it's very much the done thing for musicians. Even very, very good, successful professional musicians, the vast majority of them, a lot of their income is from teaching. And Because the way that we learn music still has a lot of one-on-one tuition. There's a lot of demand for people to do that because there are only so many hours in the day that people have to give that attention. And I really like one-on-one teaching as well, which is something that we don't get very often in improv, but it means that you get to be completely flexible and take exactly what you're getting from that person and give them what they need in the moment. And I think that it's a really interesting personal connection to have with somebody.
Yeah. Sounds like scene work. Sounds like a specific scene, you know?
Yeah. And it's a lot of the same skills, I think, to be a good teacher, particularly one-on-one. You just have to pay so much attention to everything the person is giving you and thinking, okay, what does this mean? Where are they going? What do they need?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. When I teach level one improv, that's my like focus. Like I'll say to them, stop worrying about whatever you're going to do, because you're nervous about whatever you're going to do when you're in level one. You're like, am I going to make the right decision? Oh, God. So I tell them, when you're nervous, focus on the other person. What do they want? What's their thing? What's the thing that they need from you right now? And then just give them that. Then you don't have to worry about making up stuff or how am I going to get a new idea? You're just feeding off this other person and letting them lead you down the path. When, of course, in reality, they're both leading each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's something very freeing about that approach, though, because it means your possibilities are endless because there's always somebody new to play with, either as a player or they're just playing a new character.
I think the
same thing that I love about improv is what I loved about private teaching.
Yeah, that's great. That's awesome. I appreciate that you're like, nah, that's just what you do in the music community, but, you know, you sell yourself short if you had the impetus to do it, though. I mean, a lot of people are not teachers.
Yeah.
A lot of people who shouldn't do it. And it sounds like really have a good heart for it, though. So that's what people need. So that's awesome.
I hope so. I would definitely say I was an extrovert and a people person. And I just think everyone's so interesting and you get to learn so much about everyone when you do stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely. So you still do a little conducting of ensembles, you said, and occasionally play music, but your focus is on theater at this point. So did you do any theater when you were in Montreal, or did you move directly from Montreal to the UK? How did that happen?
I did a bit of improv in Montreal with Impro Montreal, Vinny, Francois, and his crew. And they're lovely. I think when I started, I wasn't, to be honest, particularly good at it. I think because I didn't have a lot of performance experience outside of music, I took a little while to find my feet and be really confident on stage. So although I started improv in Montreal, I didn't really start performing it until later when I moved to London.
So how'd you get to London? What happened that gave you that opportunity? People aren't just moving to London every day.
No, that's true. I was very, very lucky, actually. So I received a grant from the Canada Council for the Arts to come over and study music here for a year. But the studying that I was doing was just private lessons, as we do in music. So I had 1 hour a week of lessons, and then the rest of my life for a year paid for just to explore London and take a lot of improv classes and sort of settle myself in. So I wouldn't have made it over without that, I don't think.
Yeah, go Canada, giving money to artists to go do adventures and be wonderful human beings. That's awesome. Didn't know that was a thing. Extra excited for Canadian artists. Go, guys. I'm excited for you.
Yeah.
And what a cool opportunity for you. So you're like straight out of college and you're like, it's cool. Gonna move to London. Awesome.
Yeah, it was very, very exciting, to be honest.
Yeah, and a whole year you get to like live there.
Yeah. And then I just stayed.
Yeah, you did. Well, wait. So tell me, like, when you first moved to town, what was it like for you? Like, what were the things? Because you said you got there and you, like, soaked yourself into improv right away. Was that how you, like, made friends? Is that, like, what got you into a social scene? Or did you happen upon it as you were wandering around in between lessons?
I got straight into improv and acting lessons as well. And I would say, yeah, the vast, vast majority of my social circle still is people I've met through improv. I think that's one of my favorite things about it, is it often attracts people who are looking to form a community. Mm-hmm. And one just sort of forms around you, which is amazing. It's one of the most welcoming, I think, subsets of people. And I think that's especially true in big cities like London, because there are so many people who move to London and don't know anyone, that community building is in a way easier because there are people out there looking for one.
Yeah, I mean, not to mention the fact that, like, the sort of inherent qualities that go with improv are the kind of things that are the bedrock for community, like collaboration, like openness, like being cool with whatever happens in the moment, like being able to build trust in a quick and efficient manner. Like, all these things are very, like, important to improv, and also important to, you know, making new friends and feeling like you're actually doing a good job, as opposed to, I don't know, meeting weirdos at a bar and then being like, are we friends? I don't know.
Yeah. They're just good basic human skills anyway.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I actually think that everybody in the world needs to take some improv classes, if only just to calm their little angry hearts down, so that they can accept new information in the world. And it's like, yeah, sometimes it's good and sometimes it's bad. We've all done an improv show where, you know, somebody swings in, you guys are rocking and rolling, things are going great, you're like, oh yeah, this scene is awesome. And then somebody swings in and just throws crap on the stage, and you're like, what? Okay.
Yeah.
Yep. That's fine. This awesome scene is now about whatever the thing is that you've just said. And it's terrible and doesn't work with it. But, you know, you got to move through it and you got to figure it out. And the worst thing you can do is show the audience that, you know, this is shitty. Like, there's just no way. So that's what, so I really feel like everyone could benefit from having these kinds of skills.
Absolutely. I mean, I think we do, we'll still encounter people in improv who don't have those skills. Or who forget them sometimes because they're excited in a jam. But it's nice to keep reinforcing things like that. Actually, immediately before this interview, I was teaching a class I do called Play Like an Ally, which is about diversity and inclusion and what to do, even just as a player, even if you're not teaching or in charge of things, to make sure people feel included and heard and all of that. And something that we spend a lot of time on is what to do in an uncomfortable scene, because I think you don't have to be in improv very long before you'll be in a scene or on the side of the stage and a scene's going on and it just sort of gradually gets worse and worse, and you think, oh, someone should really do something about this. So I think that proactive skill of fixing or cutting or showing consequences of that is also really valuable and also something that we can get from improv.
That's really interesting. I like that. That's a wonderful, you should take that workshop on the road. It would do well in the old United States. Not that you need to come here, because I don't know if they'll let you back into the UK if you return. Oh no, you're Canadian. You can do whatever you want. Sorry.
Yeah.
Cause I was like, oh, I try not to leave because I'm worried about getting back.
Yeah.
But don't, Okay. I was like, not going down a political road. So as far as your this class goes, that sounds really helpful. Do you teach in a, like, within a school? Like, is there a school that you are teaching with, or is there, or do you do just promote individual workshops and find a space on your own and then people from all around sign up?
So a bit of both. I travel and teach just as myself. So I'm taking this workshop this year to Singapore, Tokyo, Wellington, Melbourne, and Canberra, as well as London. Yeah, I'm pretty excited. But also in London, I work at the Nursery Theatre, which is an improvised theatre place here. I'm also the director of a group called Improvable, and we do classes as well, more sort of improvised comedy. And it's a small community, so I do also sometimes substitute teach at other schools because there's only so many of us.
There are, eh? There's only so many of you? It's not like overrun?
Not yet. I think it's gradually getting to that point. I think even in the 8 years I've been in London, the improv scene has definitely exploded. It historically has been smaller than you might assume it was, given that it's London and things like Whose Line Is It Anyway sort of came out of here. But long form improv is relatively new here and largely influenced by America, which is funny because we sort of had the Whose Line Is It Anyway thing decades and decades ago, but then not that much else happened. We had to sort of re-export that. So there's a lot of Chicago style stuff here.
I love that they call it Chicago style. I've heard more than one international improviser refer to it that way, and we refer to it that way too. And I just think it's super funny, especially too, because like, who knows if even Chicago was really where it started. You know what I mean? Like Del Close has taken a lot of credit for a lot of shit, but there's a lot of people before him. And they're like, wait a minute. Wait, I was the one who said, let's keep talking. You know, it's funny. I had friends that went to Edinburgh and said that when, and perhaps it's just that particular festival, but they said that improv was kind of, you know, not the most exciting thing in the UK. Like, people in the UK were like, ugh, improv. Is that the case? Like, is it sort of like, are people over the short form Whose Line Is It Anyway thing? Are they into the long form? What's the audience reaction for you?
I think it really depends on the show. So I think people who have only vaguely heard of improv, the thing they have heard of is Whose Line Is It Anyway? Or the Comedy Store Players, who are a lot of those same people who were on it in way back in the day. But we have a few shows here that are getting bigger and bigger and starting to be known, and they tend to be things that are in a particular style that audiences might know. So there's Ostentatious, an improvised Jane Austen novel, for example. And that type of thing tends to be marketable as well, just because if you haven't heard of improv but you have heard of Jane Austen, you might be more willing to give that a try. So I think the two kinds of improv that right now the public responds well to are genre-specific shows and short form. But I think that's gradually changing. There's more and more different kinds of long form around and bigger schools and theaters doing them. So stay tuned, I suppose.
I will. I'm the number one person that is tuned in. Since I started, you're one of the first handful of international improvisers that I've talked to. And at first I was kind of just talking to, you know, improvisers all around the U.S. in different cities to showcase different theaters and say, like, look, there's people everywhere. Like, do you have to move for work? There's still an improv community, that kind of stuff. And then it started going down the rabbit hole of like, man, improv is really a universal kind of thing. Like, I wonder what makes it different in different places. And then And then I've talked to people in, you know, Japan and Australia. I got a guy from Bulgaria coming up. Like, it's super interesting to hear different ways that different cities and countries take in the kind of art. So I will stay tuned. I'm the number one person excited about knowing how improv evolves. Because I really think, like I said before, like, I really think it's a like life skill that people really need to soak up. I've been trying to figure out for me how to, because I've taught it at regular schools, you know, like an improv theater here and there. But I'm like, no, I need other people to know. My corporate workshops are the ones where the like big breakthroughs happen. I get 3 hours with, you know, some tech guys. And by the end, I want them like loving life, you know, and yeah. And that's the kind of stuff that like, I want to help them. The rest of those of us who are signing up for classes, we're already okay. Like, we have empathy, we're interested in talking to other people. Generally, there's like good and you're right about sometimes even people who are seasoned break all the rules and are terrible. And you're right, that happens sometimes. But I don't know, I just feel good about people's hearts. And I feel like improv people are good inherently. I've gone down many rabbit holes, I'm super sorry.
It's a good rabbit hole, and there are good improv people all over the world, so that's heartening.
Yeah, there really are. Plus, it's interesting to me. So tell me, okay, one thing that I've recently found. In Austin, for instance, there are 5 improv theaters, and the way that you like do the programs is that you go to an improv school, you take classes there, and then once you're in classes at a specific school, there's a lot of opportunities within that specific community that you can get. You can be cast in certain shows, you can perform at different things, and each school has a different handful of like amenities that they provide to their student base. But then once you graduate any one of the 5 programs, there's sort of an upper tier level of shows and opportunities that you can take part in as well. But it's all sort of taken care of by the schools and the theaters themselves to provide opportunities for their own students and then graduates thereof. However, I found out recently there's a lot of theaters and a lot of schools and a lot of towns that run like you make a troupe first and then that troupe tries to find shows and they perform in bars and bookstores and street corners and they then maybe get a show regularly at a theater. So these are like different styles of like how to get involved. What's the community in London, where you are, like, how do people get involved? How do they go take classes somewhere? Can they take multiple classes different places? How does that all work?
It's kind of a mix of all of those things, really. So all of the big sort of schools and theaters here do have auditions semi-regularly, either for specific shows or for groups. So there's always that way in. And some of them you have to have gone to that school, some of them you don't. The ones I work with, you don't have to have taken any classes to audition, and we love to meet new people. There's also definitely a strong element of make a group, practice a lot, go play in a pub. And a lot of smaller improv nights have sort of sprung up because people wanted stage time. So they run nights, they invite other groups. Yeah, and they're rarely packed with non-improv people, but even just playing for each other and a couple of your friends, you sort of get the reps and the stage time that you need to get better and better.
Yeah. When you teach, are you teaching mostly like workshop-based kind of things, like your Play Like an Ally workshop? Like, is there, are there other workshops that you offer, or do you also teach like, you know, different levels of beginner's improv?
So I have a handful of sort of bespoke workshops that I do, of which Play Like an Ally is one. But I also do a lot of courses and drop-ins. So the Nursery Theater in particular does drop-ins twice a week. And it's always a big jumble of people. There's almost always somebody whose first improv class it is, And there's usually at least a handful of people who have been doing it for a couple of years and sometimes even longer. So that's a really fun dynamic to balance. And then my group Improvable does 8-week courses where you sort of have a progression with the same group. So I'm really fortunate. I get to do, again, a bit of everything, which is nice. When I travel, I just do the specific workshops.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's probably smart. So Improvable is your theater. Did you start it?
So it's not a theater. It's just a group that does shows and classes. We rent spaces to do that in, though. I think in a city like London in particular, space is almost always the obstacle in terms of running classes and running nights that comes up.
Okay, so there's not like theaters with stages and stuff like that? You guys are doing stuff in like pubs and bookstores and street corners? These are my examples.
There's one sort of actual theater space, which is the Nursery Theater, which I'm fortunate that we use for Improvable shows sometimes, that sort of is a dedicated improv theater. Having said that, even the Nursery Theater is what we call a meanwhile use space. So it means that somebody else owns the building and is planning at some point to develop it. So in the meantime, they're letting us use it at a reduced rate so that we get, so they don't have to pay rates on their space being empty. There's a whole London property thing about that that I won't get into. And then London
also. That's fascinating to know.
Yeah. There's, I think, 3 more big known sort of, not theaters, but improv spaces that have improv a lot, but they're, all 3 of them are rooms in pubs that just are always improv. Yeah, so we don't have a lot of actual theater space to do improv in.
Must be difficult to do so much improv in a bar. Seems like a loud kind of place, not one for detail watching.
The places that do improv regularly, the rooms that they have are sort of closed doors from the other pubs. A lot of them are upstairs. So you get a lot of that, which of course it means that also the Nursery Theater, I think, is the only one that's wheelchair accessible, which is a different kettle of fish. Yeah. I would love in the next 10 years for London to have a handful of actual improv theaters, but it's a very expensive city to get property in anywhere close to the middle. Sure. So there's always.
Plus, sounds like if they have extra laws that say, like, you can't even have an empty building, like, that's trouble.
Yes, it's it's a bit of a can of worms to get into the market.
There's this spot in Austin that was kind of like the concrete base of buildings, not quite a building yet, right? And this company bought it. And then what they wanted to do with it changed so many times that they had a hard time getting like all the legal stuff taken care of. So it just, this big open space of concrete slabs just stayed, you know, dormant for a while. And it became a spot in Austin where people went and did like graffiti, like artistic, amazing, wild walls covered in graffiti. And the people who owned the space were like, cool, that seems fine. All right, just do what you got to do. And it became like an art gallery. It became like a spot where artists could go and paint at night, and then during the day, people would wander around. It was like a park. People would go and do that kind of stuff. So, I mean, it's funny to think, even though you're like, oh, blah, 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 this districting like story is not exciting, it kind of is, because you never know what sort of weird legal crap leads to fun. Like, it's such a landmark in town. Like, people go there all the time. I know people that take photos there. Like, it's a big deal thing now. And it was all because they were like, man, what do we do? I don't know. And then, boom. art descended.
Oh, that's amazing.
Right?
Spaces like that in London rarely exist for more than a year or two before somebody puts a hotel up.
Sure.
But I love when it happens.
Yeah. I mean, it's not downtown Austin or anything like that. Believe you me, there's more condos than there are literally anything else. Condos and hotels. They're like, live here or stay here for a short time. Whatever you'd like, that's fine.
Yeah.
man, wild. So you have been in London, you said, for 8 years. Is that right?
That sounds about right. Yeah.
Yeah. So you've spent like most of your adult life there. Do you think are you going to settle down there? Like, is this where you're going to stay? I mean, that's a big question. You don't have to answer it. It's your whole life, but.
I can't see myself living anywhere else, to be honest. I love to travel, so I'm not here all of the time.
Sure.
But it's a really nice mix of a city because there's a lot of arts going on. There's something to do every day, all the time, even in the middle of winter, somebody's doing something exciting. But it's also really friendly for the size of city that it is, actually. It's relatively easy to sort of integrate and make friends and meet new people. And it's also just such a short plane ride from so many fun places, which being from Canada is not something I'm used to at all because it takes forever to get anywhere. So yes, definitely.
Yeah. Good. I'm glad that you're having a nice time in London and that you are embracing the community and the community is embracing you. You seem to be an important part of it down there, having taught there for quite a long time. And like, really, I'm super excited for you to go do your touring of your workshops. That's going to be super great and exciting. Do you have do you have anything on your website about that tour? Like, how can people people in the various cities that you're going to, how can they get into your workshops? Do you have like a listing of that?
So some of them are just in the upcoming dates. So the festivals I'm doing are in there. I'm doing the New Zealand Improv Festival and Improvention in Canberra. The other stuff is just advertised locally, I think, through the schools. So for example, Improv Melbourne, I'm doing some workshops there. On my site, there's also a list of workshops that I do, and as of about next week, I'll be selling copies of my book, Play Like an Ally, which goes with the workshop.
You just brought up the book now! What? You're wild! You wrote a book? Tell me a little bit about it, right here at the end of the chat that we're going to have.
Yeah. So it's short. It's 40 pages long. I've printed it sort of zine style, so it's reasonably cheap and accessible because it's really important to me, especially since the book is about diversity, for it not to be wildly expensive. And it's basically, there's a handful of sort of essays and there's a lot of practical exercises. So improv warm-ups and improv games and stuff about why you might want to structure things in a certain way to encourage thing X, Y, Z. And a handful of sort of non-improv activities like group bonding and stuff like that. It was really important to me that it be short and readable and about a specific thing, just because having read so many improv books, I feel like the world doesn't need another improv manifesto. And even if it did, I'm not quite fancy enough for it need to be from me. Play Like an Ally is something that I feel really strongly about. And one of the reasons why I sort of get to tour so much is that I really push that side of things. So I do a workshop called Play Like an Ally. And the other one that I do a lot abroad is called Improvising Gender. So it's about playing all different genders besides your own. And I think the global improv community is just sort of at a point where it wants that. So that's nice.
Yeah. No, you've totally got your finger on the pulse, like for real. I'm glad that you have the book, to be honest, because when you listed off the places to take the workshop, none of them are where I am located. So I was like, oh, okay, cool. I'll tell my friends in the other cities, but I won't be able to do it. But now that there's a book, I'm really excited about that. I really think that the idea of playing like an ally and being sensitive to the idea of improvising gender is so great. Like, it's such an important part of the social and cultural revolution that's happening right now that, you know, I think people will really appreciate that. I know that that's probably one of the number one things that people are talking about. You know, little various improv Facebook groups that I'm part of, people post things about, you know, somebody's overbearing or what happens when they make me a prostitute again, like all sorts of like different things to deal with. And the fact that now I can get this book and share it with some of the people to like help them maybe teach better or have a better way of handling when things get awkward, so helpful. That is great. Thank you for doing that.
Sure. I mean, it's super important for that reason, but also I think improv has sort of grown to the point where a lot of us have been doing it for a while, and you can get to a point where you think, ah, I get what this is. Or even to the point where a couple lines into a scene, you think, ah, I know what the rest of this scene is going to be. I've played it 7 times already. One of the reasons why I push so hard on diversity and et cetera is because I think beyond just being the nice thing to do, it's how we keep improv growing and alive and how it continues to be able to surprise and inspire us. Because if everyone you're playing with has the same background as you, probably a lot of your gut instincts are going to be the same. And when you start, that can kind of feel like, oh, we have so much synergy, we're geniuses. But I think after a while, you really need different gut instincts and different backgrounds, different pools of information to draw from, because you can only do, I think, so many scenes about Dungeons and Dragons, for example, before we get it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Man, that's another really great way to look at it as well. And what a great way to like keep this idea fresh no matter when it comes out. Because, you know, 5-10 years from now, maybe we'll be past the cultural revolution. But that idea of keeping it fresh, of keeping the people around you, of making sure that all of us don't just have the same impetus when it comes to making moves. Super smart. I'm psyched that I got to talk to you. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day and for, you know, just being there in London and teaching such great stuff and taking care of your students. I really appreciate you being on the podcast.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed myself.
Cool.
I really like the podcast. There's so many fun people on it.
I appreciate that. Yeah, I'm trying to, if you have any friends, send them to me. I want to tell everyone's story. I think it's important not only for us to hear about different people's perspectives, but also to see where they're at. Like, you seem like things are rocking and rolling for you. You're about to go on tour. You just wrote a book. Like, that is awesome. But occasionally I talk to people and they're like, I mean, even personally, I'm like, oh, I've hit a wall. I don't know what's happening, but that doesn't mean that we're not still artists. We're just trudging through the mire, trying to figure it out. And you, sir, have been very inspiring to me. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Well, hey, head back out to teach more wonderful classes. I hope you enjoy the rest of your day and good luck on the upcoming tour. And I will tell everybody I can about your new book coming up soon, Play Like an Ally.
Great. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast.